were curious about him, especially Bonnie, who'd asked him one day when she came home early and surprised him in the kitchen if he'd been married and if he had any kids. Myers nodded. Bonnie looked at him and waited for him to go on, but he didn't. Saul was curious, too. What kind of work do you do, he wanted to know. I'm just curious. This is a small town and I know people. I grade lumber at the mill myself. Only need one good arm to do that. But sometimes there are openings. I could put in a word, maybe. What's your regular line of work? Do you play any instruments? Bonnie asked. Saul has a guitar, she said. I don't know how to play it, Saul said. I wish I did. Myers kept to his room, where he was writing a letter to his wife. It was a long letter, and he felt an important one. Perhaps the most important letter he'd ever written in his life. In the letter, he was attempting to tell his wife that he was sorry for everything that had happened, and that he hoped someday she would forgive him. I would get down on my knees and ask forgiveness if that would help. After Saul and Bonnie both left, he sat in the living room with his feet on the coffee table and drank instant coffee while he read the newspaper from the evening before. Once in a while, his hands trembled, and the newspaper began rattling in the empty house. Now and then the telephone rang, but he never made a move to answer it. It wasn't for him, because nobody knew he was here. Through his window at the rear of the house, he could see up the valley to a series of steep mountain peaks whose tops were covered with snow, even though it was August. Lower down on the mountains, timber covered the slopes and the sides of the valley. The river coursed down the valley, frothing and boiling over rocks and under granite embankments until it burst out of its confines at the mouth of the valley, slowed a little as if it had spent itself, then picked up strength again and plunged into the ocean. When Saul and Bonnie were gone, Myers often sat in the sun in a lawn chair out back and looked up the valley toward the peaks. Once he saw an eagle soaring down the valley, and on another occasion he saw a deer picking its way along the riverbank. He was sitting out there like that one afternoon when a big flatbed truck pulled up in the drive with a load of wood. You must be Saul's roomer, the man said, talking out of the truck window. Myers nodded. Saul said to just dump this wood in the backyard and he'd take care of it from there. I'll move out of your way, Myers said. He took the chair and moved to the back step where he stood and watched the driver back the truck up onto the lawn, then push something inside the cab until the truck bed began to elevate. In a minute, the 6-foot logs began to slide off the truck bed and pile up on the ground. The bed rose even higher, and all of the chunks rolled off with a loud bang onto the lawn. The driver touched the lever again, and the truck bed went back to its normal place. Then he revved his engine, honked, and drove away. What are you going to do with that wood out there? Myers asked Saul that night. Saul was standing at the stove, frying smelt, when Myers surprised him by coming into the kitchen. Bonnie was in the shower. Myers could hear the water running. Why, I'm going to saw it up and stack it if I can find the time between now and September. I'd like to do it before the rain starts. Maybe I could do it for you, Myers said. You ever cut wood before? Saul said. He'd taken the frying pan off the stove and was wiping the fingers of his left hand with a paper towel. I couldn't pay you anything for doing it. It's something I was going to do anyway, just as soon as I get a weekend to my name. I'll do it, Myers said. I can use the exercise. You know how to use a power saw? And an axe and a maul? You can show me, Myers said. I learn fast. It was important to him that he cut the wood. Saul put the pan of smelt back on the burner. Then he said, okay, I'll show you after supper. You had anything to eat yet? Why don't you have a bite to eat with us? I ate something already, Myers said. Saul nodded. Let me get this grub on the table for Bonnie and me then, and after we eat, I'll show you. I'll be out back, Myers said. Saul didn't say anything more. He nodded to himself, as if he was thinking about something else. Myers took one of the folding chairs and sat down on it and looked at the pile of wood and then up the valley at the mountains where the sun was shining off the snow. It was nearly evening. The peaks thrust up into some clouds, and mist seemed to be falling from them. He could hear the river crashing through the undergrowth down in the valley. I heard talking, Myers heard Bonnie say to Saul in the kitchen. It's the rumor, Saul said. He asked me if he could cut up that load of wood out back. How much does he want to do it? Bonnie wanted to know. Did you tell him we can't pay much? I told him we can't pay anything. He wants to do it for nothing. That's what he said anyway. Nothing. She didn't say anything for a time. Then Myers heard her say, I guess he doesn't have anything else to do. Later, Saul came outside and said, I guess we can get started now if you're still game. Myers got up out of the lawn chair and followed Saul over to the garage. Saul brought out two sawhorses and set them up on the lawn. Then he brought out a power saw. The sun had dropped behind the town. In another 30 minutes, it would be dark. Myers rolled down the sleeves of his shirt and buttoned the cuffs. Saul worked without saying anything. He grunted as he lifted one of the 6-foot logs and positioned it on the sawhorses. Then he began to use the saw, working steadily for a while. Sawdust flew. Finally, he stopped sawing and stepped back. You get the idea, he said. Myers took the saw, nosed the blade into the cut Saul had started, then began sawing. He found a rhythm and stayed with it. He kept pressing, leaning into the saw. In a few minutes, he sawed through and the two halves of the log dropped onto the ground. That's the idea, Saul said. You'll do, he said. He picked up the 2 blocks of wood and carried them over and put them alongside the garage. Every so often, not every piece of wood, but maybe every 5th or 6th piece, you'll want to split it with the axe down the middle. Don't worry about making kindling. I'll take care of that later. Just split about every 5th or 6th chunk you have. I'll show you. And he propped the chunk up and, with a blow of the axe, split the wood into 2 pieces. You try it now, he said. Myers stood the block on its end, just as Saul had done, and he brought the axe down and split the wood. That's good, Saul said. He put the chunks of wood by the garage. Stack them up about so high, and then come out this way with your stack. I'll lay some plastic sheeting over it once it's all finished. But you don't have to do this, you know. It's all right, Myers said. I want to, or I wouldn't have asked. Saul shrugged. Then he turned and went back to the house. Bonnie was standing in the doorway, watching, and Saul stopped and reached his arm around Bonnie, and they both looked at Myers. Myers picked up the saw and looked at them. He felt good suddenly, and he grinned. Saul and Bonnie were taken by surprise at first. Saul grinned back, and then Bonnie. Then they went back inside. Myers put another piece of wood on the sawhorses and worked a while, sawing, until the sweat on his forehead began to feel chill and the sun had gone down. The porch light came on. Myers kept on working until he'd finished the piece he was on. He carried the 2 pieces over to the garage, and then he went in, used his bathroom to wash up, then sat at the table in his room and wrote in his notebook. I have sawdust in my shirt sleeves tonight, he wrote. It's a sweet smell. That night, he lay awake for a long time. Once he got out of bed and looked out the window at the mound of wood which lay in the backyard, and then his eyes were drawn up the valley to the mountains. The moon was partially obscured by clouds, but he could see the peaks and the white snow, and when he raised his window, the sweet, cool air poured in, and farther off, he could hear the river coursing down the valley. The next morning, it was all he could do to wait until they'd left the house before he went out back to begin work. He found a pair of gloves on the back step that Saul must have left for him. He sawed and split wood until the sun stood directly over his head, and then he went inside and ate a sandwich and drank some milk. Then he went back outside and began again. His shoulders hurt and his fingers were sore, and in spite of the gloves, he'd picked up a few splinters and could feel blisters rising, but he kept on. He decided that he would cut this wood and split it and stack it before sunset, and that it was a matter of life and death that he do so. I must finish this job, he thought, or else. He stopped to wipe his sleeve over his face. By the time Saul and Bonnie came in from work that night, first Bonnie as usual and then Saul, Myers was nearly through. A thick pile of sawdust lay between the sawhorses and, except for 2 or 3 blocks still in the yard, all of the wood lay stacked in tiers against the garage. Saul and Bonnie stood in the doorway without saying anything. Myers looked up from his work for a minute and nodded, and Saul nodded back. Bonnie just stood there looking, breathing through her mouth. Myers kept on. Saul and Bonnie went back inside and began on their supper. Afterward, Saul turned on the porch light, as he'd done the evening before. Just as the sun went down and the moon appeared over the mountains, Myers split the last chunk and gathered up the two pieces and carried the wood over to the garage. He put away the sawhorses, the saw, the axe, a wedge, and the maul. Then he went inside. Saul and Bonnie sat at the table, but they hadn't begun on their food. "You better sit down and eat with us," Saul said. "Sit down," Bonnie said. "Not hungry just yet," Myers said. Saul didn't say anything. He nodded. Bonnie waited a minute and then reached for a platter. "You got it all, I'll bet," Saul said. Myers said, "I'll clean up that sawdust tomorrow." Saul moved his knife back and forth over his plate as if to say, "Forget it." "I'll be leaving in a day or two," Myers said. "Somehow I figured you would be," Saul said. "I don't know why I felt that, but I didn't think somehow when you moved in you'd be here all that long." "No refunds on the rent," Bonnie said. "Hey, Bonnie," Saul said. "It's okay," Myers said. "No, it isn't," Saul said. "It's all right," Myers said. He opened the door to the bathroom, stepped inside, and shut the door. As he ran water into the sink, he could hear them talking out there, but he couldn't hear what they were saying. He showered, washed his hair, and put on clean clothes. He looked at the things of his in the room that had come out of his suitcase just a few days ago, a week ago, and figured it would take him about 10 minutes to pack up and be gone. He could hear the TV start up on the other side of the house. He went to the window and raised it and looked again at the mountains, with the moon lying over them. No clouds now, just the moon, and the snow-capped mountains. He looked at the pile of sawdust out in back, and at the woods stacked against the shadowy recesses of the garage. He listened to the river for a while. Then he went over to the table and sat down and opened the notebook and began to write. "The country I'm in is very exotic. It reminds me of some place I've read about but never traveled to before now. Outside my window I can hear a river, and in the valley behind the house there is a forest and precipices and mountain peaks covered with snow. Today I saw a wild eagle and a deer, and I cut and chopped 2 cords of wood." Then he put the pen down and held his head in his hands for a moment. Pretty soon he got up and undressed and turned off the light. He left the window open when he got into bed. It was okay like that. What would you like to see?
We were to have dinner with Pete Peterson and his wife Betty the night before our departure. Pete owned a restaurant that overlooked the highway and the Pacific Ocean. Early in the summer, we had rented a furnished house from him that sat 100 yards or so back behind the restaurant, just at the edge of the parking lot. Some nights when the wind was coming in off the ocean, we could open the front door and smell the steaks being charbroiled in the restaurant's kitchen, and see the gray flume of smoke rising from the heavy brick chimney. And always, day and night, we lived with the hum of the big freezer fans in back of the restaurant, a sound we grew used to. Pete's daughter Leslie, a thin blonde woman who'd never acted very friendly, lived in a smaller house nearby that also belonged to Pete. She managed his business affairs and had already been over to take a quick inventory of everything. We had rented the house furnished, right down to bed linen and an electric can opener, and had given us our deposit check back and wished us luck. She was friendly that morning she came through the house with her clipboard and inventory list, and we exchanged pleasantries. She didn't take much time with the inventory, and she already had our deposit check made out.
"Dad's going to miss you," she said. "It's funny. He's tough as shoe leather, you know, but he's going to miss you. He's said so. He hates to see you go. Betty, too."
Betty was her stepmother and looked after Leslie's children when Leslie dated or went off to San Francisco for a few days with her boyfriend. Pete and Betty, Leslie and her kids, Sarah and I, We all lived behind the restaurant within sight of one another, and I'd see Leslie's kids going back and forth from their little place to Pete and Betty's. Sometimes the kids would come over to our house and ring the doorbell and stand on the step and wait. Sarah would invite them in for cookies or pound cake and let them sit at the kitchen table like grown-ups and ask about their day and take an interest in their answers. Our own children had left home before we moved to this northern coastal region of California. Our daughter, Cindy, was living with several other young people in a house on several rocky acres of ground outside of Ukiah in Mendocino County. They kept bees and raised goats and chickens and sold eggs and goat's milk and jars of honey. The women worked on patchwork quilts and blankets, too, and sold those when they could. But I don't want to call it a commune. I'd have a harder time dealing with it, from what I've heard about communes, if I called it a commune, where every woman was every man's property, things like that. Say she lived with friends on a little farm where everyone shared the labor. But so far as we knew anyway, they were not involved in organized religion or any sort of sect. We had not heard from her for nearly 3 months, except for a jar of honey arriving in the mail one day, and a patch of heavy red cloth, part of a quilt she was working on. There was a note wrapped around the jar of honey, which said, "Dear Mom and Dad, I sewed this myself, and I put this honey up myself. I am learning to do things here. Love, Cindy." But two of Sarah's letters went unanswered, and then that fall, the Jonestown thing happened, and we were wild for a day or two that she could be there for all we knew in British Guiana. We only had a post office box number in Ukiah for her. I called the sheriff's office down there and explained the situation, and he drove out to the place to take a head count and carry a message from us. She called that night, and first Sarah talked to her and wept, and then I talked to her and wept with relief. Cindy wept, too. Some of her friends were down there in Jonestown. Note: in November 1978, 909 members of the People's Temple cult, led by Jim Jones, 1931 to 1978, committed mass suicide at Jonestown, their jungle settlement in Guyana. End of note. She said it was raining and she was depressed, but the depression would pass, she said. She was where she wanted to be and doing what she wanted to do. She'd write us a long letter and send us a picture soon. So when Leslie's children came to visit, Sarah always took a large and real interest in them and sat them down at the table and made them cocoa and served them cookies or pound cake and took a genuine interest in their stories. But we were moving. We had decided to separate. I was going to Vermont to teach for a semester in a small college, and Sarah was going to take an apartment in Eureka, a nearby town. At the end of 4.5 months, at the end of the college semester, then we'd take a look at things and see. There was no one else involved for either of us, thank God, and we had neither of us had anything to drink now for nearly a year, almost the amount of time we had been living in Pete's house together, and somehow there was just enough money to get me back east and to get Sarah set up in her apartment. She was already doing research and secretarial work for the history department at the college in Eureka, and if she kept the same job, even, and the car, and had only herself to support, she could get by all right. We'd live apart for the semester, me on the East Coast, she on the West, and then we'd take stock, see what was what. While we were cleaning the house, me washing the windows and Sarah down on her hands and knees cleaning woodwork, the baseboards and corners, with a pan of soapy water and an old t-shirt, Betty knocked on the door. It was a point of honor for us to clean this house and clean it well before we left. We had even taken a wire brush and scoured the bricks around the fireplace. We'd left too many houses in a hurry in the past, and left them damaged or in a shambles somehow, or else left owing rent and maybe having to move our things in the middle of the night. This time it was a point of honor to leave this house clean, to leave it immaculate, to leave it in better condition even than we had found it. And after we'd set the date we were going to leave, we had set to work with a passion to erase any signs of ourselves in that house. So when Betty came to the door and knocked, we were hard at work in different rooms of the house and didn't hear her at first. Then she knocked again a little louder, and I put down my cleaning materials and came out of the bedroom. "I hope I'm not disturbing you," she said, the color high in her cheeks. She was a little compact woman with blue slacks and a pink blouse that hung out over her slacks. Her hair was short and brown, and she was somewhere in her late 40s, younger than Pete. She had been waitressing at Pete's restaurant and was friends with Pete and his first wife, Evelyn, Leslie's mother. Then, we had been told, Evelyn, who was only 54, was returning home from a shopping trip into Eureka. Just as she pulled off the highway into the parking lot behind the restaurant and headed across the lot for her own driveway, her heart stopped. The car kept going, slowly enough, but with enough momentum to knock down the little wood rail fence, cross her flower bed of azaleas, and come to a stop against the porch with Evelyn slumped behind the wheel, dead. A few months later, Pete and Betty had married, and Betty had quit waitressing and become stepmother to Leslie and grandmother to Leslie's children. Betty had been married before and had grown children living in Oregon, who drove down now and then to visit. Betty and Pete had been married for 5 years, and from what we could observe, they were happy and well-suited to each other. "Come in, please, Betty," I said. "We were just cleaning up some around here." I moved aside and held the door. "I can't," she said. "I have the children I'm looking after today. I have to get right back. But Pete and I were wondering if you could come to dinner before you leave." She spoke in a quiet, shy manner and held a cigarette in her fingers. "Friday night?" she said, "if you can." Sarah brushed her hair and came to the door. "Betty, come in out of the cold," she said. The sky was gray and the wind was pushing clouds in off the sea. "No, no, thank you, I can't. I left the children coloring, I have to get back. Pete and I, we just wondered if you two would come to dinner. Maybe Friday night, the night before you leave?" She waited and looked shy. Her hair lifted in the wind and she drew on her cigarette. "I'd like that very much," Sarah said. "Is that all right with you, Phil? We don't have any plans, I don't think. Is it all right?"
"That's very nice of you, Betty," I said. "We'd be happy to come to dinner."
"About 7:30? Betty said. 7:30, Sarah said. "This pleases us very much, Betty, more than I can say. It's very kind and thoughtful of you and Pete."
Betty shook her head and was embarrassed.
"Pete said he's sorry you're leaving. He said it's been like having more family here. He said it's been an honor having you here as renters."
She started backing down the steps. The color was still high in her cheeks.
"Friday night, then," she said. "Thank you, Betty. I mean that," Sarah said. "Thank you again. It means a lot to us."
Betty waved her hand and shook her head. Then she said,
"Until Friday, then."
And the way in which she said it somehow made my throat tighten. I shut the door after she'd turned away, and Sarah and I looked at each other.
"Well," Sarah said, "this is a switch, isn't it? Getting invited to dinner by our landlord instead of having to skip town and hide out somewhere."
"I like Pete," I said. "He's a good man."
"Betty, too," Sarah said. "She's a good, kind woman, and I'm glad she and Pete have each other."
"Things come around sometimes," I said. "Things work out." Sarah didn't say anything. She bit her lower lip for a minute. Then she went on into the back room to finish scrubbing. I sat down on the sofa and smoked a cigarette. When I'd finished, I got up and went back to the other room and my mop bucket. The next day, Friday, we finished cleaning the house and did most of our packing. Sarah wiped down the stove once more, put aluminum foil under the burners, and gave the counter a last going over. Our suitcases and a few boxes of books stood in one corner of the living room, ready for our departure. We'd have dinner tonight with the Petersons, and we'd get up the next morning and go out for coffee and breakfast. Then we'd come back and load the car. There wasn't all that much left after 20 years of moves and disorder. We'd drive to Eureka and unload the car and put things away in Sarah's efficiency apartment, which she'd rented a few days before. And then sometime before 8 o'clock that night, she'd drive me to the little airport, where I would begin my trip east, planning to make connections with a midnight flight leaving San Francisco for Boston, and she would begin her new life in Eureka. She'd already, a month before, when we began discussing these matters, taken off her wedding ring. not so much in anger as just in sadness one night when we had been making these plans. She had worn no ring at all for a few days, and then she had bought an inexpensive little ring mounted with a turquoise butterfly because, as she said, that finger felt naked. Once, some years before that, in a rage, she had twisted the wedding band off her finger and thrown it across the living room. I had been drunk and left the house, and when we talked about that night a few days later, and I asked her about her wedding ring, she said, "I still have it. I just put it in a drawer. You don't really think I'd throw my wedding ring away, do you?" A little later, she put it back on, and she'd kept wearing it, even through the bad times, up until a month ago. She'd also stopped taking birth control pills and had herself fitted with a diaphragm. So we worked that day around the house and finished the packing and the cleaning, and then, a little after 6 o'clock, we took our showers and wiped down the shower stall again and dressed and sat in the living room, she on the sofa in a knit dress and blue scarf, her legs drawn up under her, and me in the big chair by the window. I could see the back of Pete's restaurant from where I sat, and the ocean a few miles beyond the restaurant, and the meadows and the copses of trees that lay between the front window and the houses. We sat without talking. We had talked and talked and talked. Now we sat without talking and watched it turn dark outside and the smoke feather up from the restaurant chimney. "Well," Sarah said and straightened out her legs on the sofa. She pulled her skirt down a little. She lit a cigarette. "What time is it? Maybe we should go. They said 7:30, didn't they? What time is it?"
"It's 7:10, I said.
7:10, she said. "This is the last time we'll be able to sit in the living room like this and watch it get dark. I don't want to forget this. I'm glad we have a few minutes."
In a little while, I got up for my coat. On my way to the bedroom, I stopped at the end of the sofa where she sat and bent and kissed her on the forehead. She raised her eyes to mine after the kiss and looked at me.
"Bring my coat, too," she said.
I helped her into the coat, and then we left the house and went across the lawn in the back edge of the parking lot to Pete's house. Sarah kept her hands in her pockets, and I smoked a cigarette as we walked. Just before we got to the gate at the little fence surrounding Pete's house, I threw down my cigarette and took Sarah's arm. The house was new and had been planted with a tough climbing vine that had spread over the fence. A little wooden lumberjack was nailed to the banister that ran around the porch. When the wind blew, the little man began sawing his log. He was not sawing at this moment, but I could feel the dampness in the air, and I knew the wind would come soon. Potted plants were on the porch and flower beds on either side of the sidewalk, but whether they had been planted by Betty or the first wife, there was no way of telling. Some children's toys and a tricycle were on the porch. The porch light was burning, and just as we started up the steps, Pete opened the door and greeted us.
"Come in, come in," he said, holding the screen door with one hand.
He took Sarah's hands in his hands, and then he shook hands with me. He was a tall, thin man, 60 years old or so, with a full head of neatly combed gray hair. His shoulders gave the impression of bulk, but he was not heavy. He was wearing a gray Pendleton shirt, dark slacks, and white shoes. Betty came to the door as well, nodding and smiling. She took our coats while Pete asked us what we'd like to drink.
"What can I get you?" he said. "Name it. If I don't have it, we'll send over to the restaurant for it."
Pete was a recovering alcoholic, but kept wine and liquor around the house for guests. He'd once told me that when he'd bought his first restaurant and was cooking 16 hours a day, he drank 2/5 of whiskey during those 16 hours and was hard on his health. Now he'd quit drinking, had been hospitalized for it, we'd heard, and hadn't had a drink in 6 years. But like many alcoholics, he still kept it around the house. Sarah said she'd have a glass of white wine. I looked at her. I asked for a Coke. Pete winked at me and said,
"You want a little something in the Coke, something to help take the dampness out of your bones."
"No thanks, Pete, but maybe you could toss a piece of lime in it, thanks," I said.
"Good fellow," he said. "For me, it's the only way to fly anymore."
I saw Betty turn a dial on the microwave oven and push a button. Pete said,
Betty, will you have some wine with Sarah, or what would you like, honey?
I'll have a little wine, Pete,
Betty said.
Phil, here's your Coke, Pete said.
Sarah, he said, and gave her a glass of wine.
Betty, now there's lots more of everything. Let's go in where it's comfortable.
We passed through the living room. The table was already set with four place settings, fine china, and crystal wine glasses. We went through to the living room, and Sarah and I sat together on one of the sofas. Pete and Betty sat across the room on another sofa. There were bowls of cocktail nuts within reach on a coffee table, cauliflower heads, celery sticks, and a bowl of vegetable dip beside the peanuts.
We're so glad you could come,
Betty said.
We've been looking forward to this all week.
We're going to miss you, Pete said. And that's a fact. I hate to see you go, but I know that's life. People have to do what they have to do. I don't know how to say this, but it's been an honor having you over there in the house, you both being teachers and all. I have a great respect for education, though I don't have much myself. It's like a big family here, you know that. And we've come to look on you as part of that family.
Here's
to your health. To you, he said. And to the future.
We raised our glasses and then we drank.
We're so glad you feel that way, Sarah said. This is very important to us, this dinner. We've been looking forward to it more than I can tell you. It means a great deal to us.
Pete said,
We're going to miss you, that's all.
He shook his head.
It's been very, very good for us living here, Sarah said. We can't tell you.
There was something about this fellow I liked when I first saw him, Pete said to Sarah. I'm glad I rented the house to him. You can tell a lot from a man when you first meet him. I liked this fellow of yours. You take care of him now.
Sarah reached for a celery stick. A little bell went off in the kitchen and Betty said,
Excuse me,
and left the room.
Let me freshen those up for you, Pete said.
He left the room with our glasses and returned in a minute with more wine for Sarah and a full glass of Coke for me. Betty began carrying in things from the kitchen to put on the dining room table.
I hope you like surf and turf, Pete said. Sirloin steak and lobster tail.
It sounds fine. It's a dream dinner, Sarah said. I guess we can eat now, Betty said. If you'd like to come to the table. Pete sits here always,
Betty said.
This is Pete's place. Phil, you sit there. Sarah, you sit there, across from me.
Man who sits at the head of the table picks up the check,
Pete said and laughed. It was a fine dinner. Green salad dotted with tiny fresh shrimp, clam chowder, lobster tail, and steak. Sarah and Betty drank wine. Pete drank mineral water. I stayed with the Coke. We talked a little about Jonestown after Pete brought it up, but I could see that conversation made Sarah nervous. Her lips paled, and I managed to steer us around to salmon fishing.
I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to go out, Pete said. But the sports fishermen aren't doing anything yet. It's only the fellows with the commercial licenses that are getting them. And they're going way out. In another week or two, maybe the salmon will have moved in. Any time now, really, Pete said. But you'll be on the other side of the country then.
I nodded. Sarah picked up her wine glass.
I bought 150 pounds of fresh salmon from a guy yesterday, and that's what I'm featuring on the menu over there now. Fresh salmon, Pete said. I put it right in the freezer and fresh froze it. Fellow drove up with it in his pickup truck, an Indian, and I asked him what he was asking for it, and he said $3.50 a pound. I said $3.25. And he said we had a deal. So I fresh froze it and I have it over there on the menu right now.
Well, this was fine, I said. I like salmon, but it couldn't have been any better than what we had here tonight. This was delicious.
We're so glad you could come, Betty said. This is wonderful, Sarah said. But I don't think I've ever seen so much lobster tail and steak. I don't think I can eat all of mine. Whatever's left, we'll put in a doggy bag for you,
Betty said and blushed.
Just like at the restaurant. But save room for dessert.
Let's have coffee in the living room, Pete said.
Pete has some slides we took when we were on our trip, Betty said. If you'd care to see them, we thought we might put up the screen after dinner.
There's brandy for those who want it, Pete said.
Betty'll have some, I know. Sarah, you'll have some. That's a good girl. It doesn't bother me a bit to have it around and have my guests drink it. Drinking's a funny thing, Pete said.
We had moved back into the living room. Pete was putting up a screen and talking.
I always keep a supply of everything on hand, as you noticed out there, but I haven't touched a drink of anything alcoholic myself for 6 years. Now this was after drinking more than a quart a day for 10 years after I retired from the service. But I quit, God knows how, but I quit, I just quit. I turned myself over to my doctor and just said, help me, Doc. I want to get off this stuff, Doc. Can you help me? Well, he made a couple of calls. Said he knew some fellows used to have trouble with it. Said there'd been a time when he'd had trouble with it, too. The next thing I knew, I was on my way to an establishment down there near Santa Rosa. It was in Calistoga, California. I spent 3 weeks there. When I came home, I was sober, and the desire to drink had left me. Evelyn, that's my first wife, she met me at the door when I came home and kissed me on the lips for the first time in years. She hated alcohol. Her father and a brother both died from it. It can kill you, too, don't forget it. Well, she kissed me on the lips for the first time that night, and I haven't had a drink since I went into that place at Calistoga.
Betty and Sarah were clearing the table. I sat on the sofa and smoked while Pete talked. After he'd put up the screen, he took a slide projector out of a box and set it on an end table. He plugged in the cord and flicked a switch on the projector. Light beamed onto the screen, and a little fan in the projector began to run.
We have enough slides that we could look at pictures all night and then some, Pete said. We have slides here from Mexico, Hawaii, Alaska, the Middle East, Africa, too. What would you like to see?
Sarah came in and sat down on the other end of the sofa from me.
What would you like to see, Sarah? Pete said. You name it.
Alaska, Sarah said. And the Middle East. We were there for a while years ago in Israel. I've always wanted to go to Alaska.
We didn't get to Israel, Betty said, coming in with the coffee.
We were on a tour that went only to Syria, Egypt, and Lebanon.
It's a tragedy what's happened in Lebanon, Pete said. It used to be the most beautiful country in the Middle East. I was there as a kid in the Merchant Marines in World War II. I thought then, I promised myself then, I'd go back there someday. And then we had the opportunity, Betty and me, didn't we, Betty?
Betty smiled and nodded.
Let's see those pictures of Syria and Lebanon, Sarah said. Those are the ones I'd like to see. I'd like to see them all, of course, but if we have to choose.
So Pete began to show slides, both he and Betty commenting as the memory of the places came back to them.
There's Betty trying to get on a camel, Pete said. She needed a little help from that fellow there in the burnous.
Betty laughed and her cheeks turned red. Another slide flashed on the screen and Betty said,
There's Pete talking with an Egyptian officer.
Where he's pointing, that mountain behind us there. Here, let me see if I can bring that in closer, Pete said. The Jews are dug in there. We could see them through the binoculars they let us use. Jews all over that hill, like ants, Pete said.
Pete believes that if they had kept their planes out of Lebanon, there wouldn't be all that trouble there, Betty said. The poor Lebanese.
There, Pete said. There's the group at Petra, the lost city. It used to be a caravan city, but then it was just lost. Lost and covered over by sand for hundreds of years. And then it was discovered again, and we drove there from Damascus and Land Rovers. Look how pink the stone is. Those carvings in the stone are more than 2,000 years old, they say. There used to be 20,000 souls who lived there. And then the desert just covered it up and was forgotten about. It's what's going to happen to this country if we aren't careful.
We had more coffee and watched some more slides of Pete and Betty at the souks in Damascus. Then Pete turned off the projector and Betty went out to the kitchen and returned with carameled pears for dessert and more coffee. We ate and drank and Pete said again how they would miss us.
You're good people, Pete said. I hate to see you leave, but I know it's in your best interests or you wouldn't be going. Now you'd like to see some slides from Alaska. Is that what you said, Sarah?
Alaska, yes,
Sarah said. We'd talked once about going to Alaska years ago, didn't we, Phil? Once we were all set to go to Alaska. But we didn't go at the last minute. Do you remember that, Phil?
I nodded.
Now you'll go to Alaska, Pete said.
The first slide showed a tall, trim, red-haired woman standing on the deck of a ship with a snow-covered range of mountains in the distance behind her. She was wearing a white fur coat and facing the camera with a smile on her face.
That's Evelyn, Pete's first wife, Betty said. She's dead now.
Pete threw another slide onto the screen. The same red-haired woman was wearing the same coat and shaking hands with a smiling Eskimo in a parka. Large dried fish were hanging on poles behind the two figures. There was an expanse of water and more mountains.
That's Evelyn again, Pete said. These were taken in Point Barrow, Alaska, the northernmost settlement in the U.S.
Then there was a shot of the main street, little low buildings with slanted metal roofs, signs saying King Salmon Cafe, cards, liquor, rooms. One slide showed a Colonel Sanders fried chicken parlor with a billboard outside showing Colonel Sanders in a parka and fur boots. We all laughed.
That's Evelyn again, Betty said as another slide flashed on the screen.
These were made before Evelyn died, Pete said. We'd always talked about going to Alaska too, Pete said. I'm glad we made that trip before she died.
Good timing, Sarah said. Evelyn was a good friend to me, Betty said. It was a lot like losing my sister.
We saw Evelyn boarding a plane back for Seattle, and we saw Pete smiling and waving, emerging from that same plane after it had landed in Seattle.
It's heating up, Pete said. I'll have to turn off the projector for a little while to let it cool off. What would you like to see then? Hawaii? Sarah, it's your night, you say.
Sarah looked at me. I guess we should think about going home, Pete, I said. It's going to be a long day tomorrow.
Yes, we should, Sarah said. We really should, I guess.
But she continued to sit there with her glass in her hand. She looked at Betty, and then she looked at Pete.
It's been a very wonderful evening for us, she said. I really have a hard time thanking you enough. This has meant a good deal to us.
No, it's us who should be thanking you, Pete said, and that's the truth. It's been a pleasure knowing you. I hope that the next time you're in this part of the country, you'll stop by here and say hello.
You won't forget us? Betty said. You won't, will you?
Sarah shook her head. Then we were on our feet and Pete was getting our coats. Betty said,
Oh, don't forget your doggy bag. This will make you a nice snack tomorrow.
Pete helped Sarah with her coat and then held my coat for me to slip my arm into. We all shook hands on the front porch.
The wind's coming up, Pete said. Don't forget us now, Pete said, and good luck.
We won't, I said. Thank you again, thanks for everything. We shook hands once more. Pete took Sarah by the shoulders and kissed her on the cheek.
You take good care of yourselves now. This fellow, too. Take good care of him, he said. You're both good people. We like you.
Thank you, Pete, Sarah said. Thank you for saying that.
I'm saying it because it's true, or else I wouldn't be saying it, Pete said.
Betty and Sarah embraced.
Well, good night to you, Betty said, and God bless you both.
We walked down the sidewalk past the flowers. I held the gate for Sarah, and we walked across the gravel parking lot to our house. The restaurant was dark. It was after midnight. Wind blew through the trees. The parking lot lights burned, and the generator in back of the restaurant hummed and turned the freezer fan inside the locker. I unlocked the door to the house. Sarah snapped on the light and went into the bathroom. I turned on the lamp beside the chair in front of the window and sat down with a cigarette. After a little while, Sarah came out, still in her coat, and sat on the sofa and touched her forehead.
It was a nice evening, she said. I won't forget it. So different from so many of our other departures, she said. Imagine, to actually have dinner with your landlord before you move.
She shook her head.
We've come a long way, I guess, if you look at it that way.
but there's a long way to go yet. Well, this is the last night we'll spend in this house, and I'm so tired from that big dinner I can hardly keep my eyes open. I think I'll go in and go to bed.
I'm going too, I said, just as soon as I finish this. We lay in bed without touching. Then Sarah turned on her side and said,
I'd like you to hold me until I get off to sleep. That's all, just hold me. I miss Cindy tonight. I hope she's all right. I pray she's all right. God help her to find her way. And God help us, she said.
After a while, her breathing became slow and regular, and I turned away from her again. I lay on my back and stared at the dark ceiling. I lay there and listened to the wind. Then, just as I started to close my eyes again, I heard something. Or rather, something that I had been hearing, I didn't hear anymore. The wind still blew, and I could hear it under the eaves of the house and singing in the wires outside the house, but something was not there any longer, and I didn't know what it was. I lay there a while longer and listened, and then I got up and went out to the living room and looked out the front window at the restaurant, the edge of moon showing through the fast-moving clouds. I stood at the window and tried to figure out what was wrong. I kept looking at the glint of ocean and then back to the darkened restaurant. Then it came to me what the odd silence was. The generator had gone off over at the restaurant. I stood there a while longer wondering what I should do, if I should call Pete. Maybe it would take care of itself in a little while and switch back on. But for some reason, I knew this wouldn't happen. He must have noticed it too, for suddenly I saw a light go on over at Pete's, and then a figure appeared on the steps with a flashlight. The figure carrying the flashlight went to the back of the restaurant and unlocked the door, and then lights began to go on in the restaurant. After a little while, after I had smoked a cigarette, I went back to bed. I went to sleep immediately. The next morning we had instant coffee and washed the cups and packed them when we were finished. We didn't talk much. There was an appliance truck behind the restaurant, and I could see Betty and Leslie coming and going from the back door of the restaurant, carrying things in their arms. I didn't see Pete. We loaded the car. We would be able to carry everything into Eureka in one load after all. I walked over to the restaurant to drop off the keys, but just as I got to the office door, it opened and Pete came out carrying a box. It's going to rot, he said. The salmon thawed out. It was just starting to freeze and then it began to thaw. I'm going to lose all this salmon. I'm going to have to give it away, get rid of it this morning. The fillets and prawns and scallops too, everything. The generator burned out, goddammit. I'm sorry, Pete, I said. We have to go now. I wanted to give you back the keys. What is it? He said and looked at me. The house keys, I said. We're leaving now. We're on our way. Give them to Leslie in there, he said. Leslie takes care of the rentals. Give her your keys. I will then. Goodbye, Pete. I'm sorry about this, but thanks again for everything. Sure, he said. Sure, don't mention it. Good luck to you. Take it easy. He nodded and went on over to his house with his box of fillets. I gave the keys to Leslie, said goodbye to her, and walked back to the car where Sarah was waiting.
What's wrong? Sarah said. What's happened? It looked like Pete didn't have the time of day for you.
The generator burned out last night at the restaurant and the freezer shut down and some of their meat spoiled.
Is that it?
She said.
That's too bad. I'm sorry to hear it. You gave them the keys, didn't you? We've said goodbye. I guess we can go now.
Yes, I said. I guess we can. Dreams. My wife is in the habit of telling me her dreams when she wakes up. I take her some coffee and juice and sit in a chair beside the bed while she wakes up and moves her hair away from her face. She has the look that people waking up have, but she also has this look in her eyes of returning from somewhere. Well, I say.
It's crazy, she says. This was a dream and a half. I dreamed I was a boy going fishing with my sister and her girlfriend, but I was drunk. Imagine that. Doesn't that beat everything? I was supposed to drive them fishing, but I couldn't find the car keys. Then when I found the keys, the car wouldn't start. Suddenly, we were at the fishing place and on the lake in a boat. A storm was coming up, but I couldn't get the motor started. My sister and her friend just laughed and laughed, but I was afraid. Then I woke up. Isn't that strange? What do you make of it?
Write it down, I said and shrugged. I didn't have anything to say. I didn't dream. I hadn't dreamed in years. Or maybe I did, but I couldn't remember anything when I woke up. One thing I'm not is an expert on dreams, my own or anybody else's. Once Dottie told me she'd had a dream right before we got married when she thought she was barking. She woke herself up and saw her little dog Bingo sitting beside the bed looking at her in what she thought was a strange way. She realized she'd been barking in her sleep. What did it mean, she wondered.
That was a bad dream, she said.
She'd added the dream to her dream book, but that was that. She didn't get back to it. She didn't interpret her dreams. She just wrote them down, and then, when she had the next one, she wrote that one down, too. I said, I'd better go upstairs. I need to use the bathroom.
I'll be along pretty soon. I have to wake up first. I want to think about this dream some more.
I left her sitting up in bed, holding her cup, but not drinking from it. She was sitting there, thinking about her dream. I didn't have to go to the bathroom after all, so I took some coffee and sat at the kitchen table. It was August, a heat wave, and the windows were open. Hot, yes, it was hot. The heat was killing. My wife and I slept in the basement for most of the month, but it was okay. We carried the mattress down there, pillows, sheets, everything. We had an end table, a lamp, an ashtray. We laughed. It was like starting over. But all the windows upstairs were open, and the windows next door, they were open too. I sat at the table, listening to Mary Rice next door. It was early, but she was up and in her kitchen in her nightgown. She was humming, and she kept it up while I listened and drank coffee. Then her children came into their kitchen. This is what she said to them.
Good morning, children. Good morning, my loved ones.
It's true. That's what their mother said to them. Then they were at the table, laughing about something, and one of the kids was banging his chair up and down, laughing.
Michael, that's enough, Mary Rice said. Finish your cereal, honey.
In a minute, Mary Rice sent her kids out of the room to get themselves dressed for school. She began to hum as she cleaned a dish. I listened, and listening, I thought, I am a rich man. I have a wife who dreams something every night, who lies there beside me until she falls asleep, and then she goes far away into some rich dream every night. Sometimes she dreams of horses and weather and people, and sometimes she even changes her sex in her dreams. I didn't miss dreaming. I had her dreams to think about if I wanted to have a dream life. And I have a woman next door who sings or else hums all day long. All in all, I felt quite lucky. I moved to the front window to watch the kids next door when they went out of their house to go to school. I saw Mary Rice kiss each of the children on the face, and I heard her say, "Goodbye, children." Then she latched the screen, stood for a minute watching her children walk down the street, then turned and went back inside. I knew her habits. She'd sleep in a few hours now. She didn't sleep when she came in from her job at night, a little after 5 in the morning. The girl who babysat for her, Rosemary Bandel, a neighbor girl, would be waiting for her and would leave and go across the street to her own house. And then the lights would glow over at Mary Rice's for the rest of the night. Sometimes, if her windows were open, like now, I'd hear classical piano music. And once I even heard Alexander Scourby reading Great Expectations.
Note, Alexander Scourby, stage, film, radio, and television actor, 1913 to 1985, who made numerous audio recordings of classics such as War and Peace, as well as the King James Bible in its entirety. End of note.
Sometimes, if I couldn't sleep, my wife sleeping and dreaming away beside me, I'd get up out of bed and go upstairs and sit at the table and listen to her music or her talking records and wait for her to pass behind a curtain or until I saw her standing behind the window shade. Once in a while, the phone rang over there at some early and unlikely hour, but she always picked it up on the third ring. The names of her children, I found out, were Michael and Susan. To my eye, they were no different from any of the other neighborhood kids, except when I'd see them, I'd think,
You kids are lucky to have a mother who sings to you. You don't need your father. Once they came to our door selling bath soap, and another time they came around selling seeds. We didn't have a garden, of course not. How could anything grow where we lived? But I bought some seeds anyway. What the hell? And on Halloween they came to the door, always with their babysitter. Their mother was working, of course. And I gave them candy bars and nodded to Rosemary Bandle. My wife and I have lived in this neighborhood longer than anyone. We've seen almost everyone come and go. Mary Rice and her husband and children moved in 3 years ago. Her husband worked for the telephone company as a lineman, and for a time, he left every morning at 7 o'clock and returned home in the evening at 5. Then he stopped coming home at 5. He came home later, or not at all. My wife noticed it, too. "I haven't seen him home over there in 3 days," she said. "I haven't either," I said. I'd heard loud voices over there the other morning, and one or both of the children were crying. Then at the market, my wife was told by the woman who lived on the other side of Mary Rice that Mary and her husband had separated. "He's moved out on her and the children," was what this woman said. "The son of a bitch." And then, not very long after, needing to support herself because her husband had quit his job and left town. Mary Rice had gone to work in this restaurant serving cocktails and, pretty soon, began staying up all night listening to music and talking records. And singing sometimes and humming other times. This same woman who lived next door to Mary Rice said she had enrolled in 2 correspondence courses from the university. She was making a new life for herself, this woman said. And the new life included her children, too. Winter was not so far away when I decided to put up the storm windows. When I was outside using my ladder, those kids from next door, Michael and Susan, came charging out of the house with their dog and let the screen door bang shut behind them. They ran down the sidewalk in their coats, kicking piles of leaves. Mary Rice came to the door and looked after them. Then she looked over at me. "Hello there," she said. "You're getting ready for winter, I see." "Yes, I am," I said. "It won't be long."
"No, it won't," she said.
Then she waited a minute as if she was going to say something else. Then she said, "It was nice talking to you." "My pleasure," I answered. That was just before Thanksgiving. About a week later, when I went into the bedroom with my wife's coffee and juice, she was already awake and sitting up and ready to tell me her dream. She patted the bed beside her, and I sat down.
"This is one for the book," she said. "Listen to this if you want to hear something."
"Go on," I said. I took a sip from her cup and handed it to her. She closed both hands around it as if her hands were cold.
"We were on a ship," she said.
"We've never been on a ship," I said.
"I know that, but we were on a ship, a big ship, a cruise ship, I guess. We were in bed, a bunk or something, when somebody knocked at the door with a tray of cupcakes. They came in, left the cupcakes, and went out. I got out of bed and went to get one of the cupcakes. I was hungry, you see, but when I touched the cupcake, it burned the tips of my fingers. Then my toes began to curl up, like they do when you're scared. And then I got back in bed, but I heard loud music. It was Scriabin. And then somebody began to rattle glasses, hundreds of glasses, maybe thousands of glasses, all of them rattling at once. I woke you up and told you about it, and you said you'd go to see what it was. While you were gone, I remember seeing the moon go by outside, go by the porthole, and then the ship must have turned or something. Then the moon came by again and lit up the whole room. Then you came back, still in your pajamas, and got back in bed and went back to sleep without saying a word. The moon was shining right outside the window, and everything in the room seemed to gleam. But still, you didn't say anything. I remember feeling a little afraid of you for not saying anything, and my toes started curling again. Then I went back to sleep, and here I am. What do you think of that? Isn't that some dream? God, what do you make of it? You didn't dream anything, did you?"
She sipped from her coffee and watched me. I shook my head.
I didn't know what to say, so all I said was that she had better put it in her notebook.
God, I don't know. They're getting pretty weird. What do you think?
Put it in your book. Pretty soon it was Christmas. We bought a tree and put it up, and on Christmas morning we exchanged gifts. Dottie bought me a new pair of mittens, a globe, and a subscription to Smithsonian Magazine. I gave her a perfume. She blushed when she opened the little package, and a new nightgown. She hugged me. Then we drove across town to have dinner with some friends. The weather became colder between Christmas and the first of the year. It snowed, and then it snowed again. Michael and Susan went outside long enough one day to build a snowman. They put a carrot in its mouth. At night, I could see the glare of the TV in their bedroom window. Mary Rice kept going back and forth to work every evening. Rosemary came in to babysit, and every night and all night, the lights burned over there. On New Year's Eve, we drove across town to our friends for dinner again, played bridge, watched some TV, and promptly at midnight, opened a bottle of champagne. I shook hands with Harold, and we smoked a cigar together. Then Dottie and I drove home. But, and this is the beginning of the hard part, when we reached our neighborhood, the street was blocked off by two police cars. The lights on top of the cars revolved back and forth. Other cars, curious motorists, had stopped, and people had come out of their houses. Most of the people were dressed up and wearing top coats, but there were a few people in nightclothes wearing heavy coats that they'd obviously put on in a hurry. Two fire engines were parked down the street. One of them sat in our front yard, and the other was in Mary Rice's driveway. I gave the officer my name and said that we lived there, where the big truck was parked.
"They're in front of our house," Dottie screamed, and the officer said we should park our car.
"What happened?" I said. "I guess one of those space heaters caught on fire. That's what somebody said, anyway. A couple of kids were in there. Three kids, counting the babysitter. She got out. The kids didn't make it, I don't guess. Smoke inhalation." We started walking down the street toward our house. Dottie walked close to me and held my arm.
"Oh my God," she said.
Up close to Mary Rice's house, under the lights thrown up by the fire trucks, I could see a man standing on the roof holding a fire hose, but only a trickle of water came out of it now. The bedroom window was broken out, and in the bedroom I could see a man moving around the room, carrying something that could have been an axe. Then a man walked out the front door with something in his arms, and I saw it was those kids' dog, and I felt terrible then. A mobile TV unit from one of the local stations was there, and a man was operating a camera that he held over his shoulder. Neighbors huddled around. The engines in the trucks were running, and now and then voices came over speakers from inside the trucks. But none of the people watching were saying anything. I looked at them, and then I recognized Rosemary, who was standing with her mother and father with her mouth open. Then they brought the children down on stretchers, the firemen, big fellows wearing boots and coats and hats, men who looked indestructible and as if they could live another 100 years. They came outside, one on either end of the stretchers, carrying the children.
"Oh, no," said the people who stood watching. And then again, "Oh, no, no,"
someone cried. They laid the stretchers on the ground. A man in a suit and wool cap stepped up and listened with a stethoscope for a heartbeat on each of the children, and then nodded to the ambulance attendants, who stepped forward to pick up the stretchers. At that moment, a little car drove up, and Mary Rice jumped out of the passenger side. She ran toward the men who were about to put the stretchers into the ambulance.
"Put them down,"
she yelled.
"Put them down."
And the attendants stopped what they were doing and put the stretchers down and then stood back. Mary Rice stood over her children and howled. Yes, there's no other word. People stepped back and then they moved forward again as she dropped to her knees in the snow beside the stretchers and put her hands on the face of one child and then the other. The man in the suit with the stethoscope stepped forward and kneeled beside Mary Rice. Another man, it might have been the fire chief or else the assistant fire chief, signaled the attendants and then stepped up to Mary Rice and helped her up and put his arm around her shoulders. The man in the suit stood on the other side of her, but he didn't touch her. The person who'd driven her home now walked up close to see what was going on,
but he was only a scared-looking kid, a busboy or a dishwasher. He had no right to be there to witness Mary Rice's grief, and he knew it. He stood back away from people, keeping his eyes on the stretchers as the men put them into the back of the ambulance.
No,
Mary Rice said and jumped toward the back of the ambulance as the stretchers were being put in. I went up to her then, no one else was doing anything, and took her arm and said, Mary, Mary Rice. She whirled on me and said, I don't know you, what do you want? She brought her hand back and slapped me in the face. Then she got into the ambulance along with the attendants, and the ambulance moved down the street, sliding, its siren going off, as the people got out of the way. I slept badly that night, and Dottie groaned in her sleep and turned again and again. I knew she was dreaming that she was somewhere far away from me all night. The next morning, I didn't ask her what she'd dreamed, and she didn't volunteer anything. But when I went in with her juice and coffee, she had her notebook on her lap along with a pen. She closed the pen up in the notebook and looked at me. What's happening next door? She asked me. Nothing, I said. The house is dark. There are tire marks all over the snow. The children's bedroom window is broken out, that's all, nothing else. Except for that, the bedroom window, you wouldn't know there'd been a fire. You wouldn't know two children had died. That poor woman, Dottie said. God, that poor unfortunate woman. God help her. And us too. From time to time that morning, people in cars drove by slowly and looked at her house. Or else people came up to the front of the house, looked at the window, looked at how the snow had been churned up in front of the house, and then went on again. Toward noon, I was looking out the window when a station wagon drove up and parked. Mary Rice and her former husband, the children's father, got out and went toward the house. They moved slowly, and the man took her arm as they went up the stairs. The porch door stood open from the night before. She went inside first, then he went in. That night on the local news, we saw the whole thing going on again. I can't watch this, Dottie said, but she watched anyway, just like I did. The film showed Mary Rice's house and a man on the roof with a hose spraying water down through the broken window. Then the children were shown being carried out, and again we watched Mary Rice dropping to her knees. Then, as the stretchers are being put into the ambulance, Mary Rice whirls on somebody and screams, "What do you want?" At noon the next day, the station wagon drove up in front of the house. As soon as it was parked, before the man could even turn off the engine, Mary Rice came down the steps. The man got out of the car, said, "Hello, Mary," and opened the passenger's door for her. Then they went off to the funeral. He stayed 4 nights after the funeral, and then the next morning when I got up, early as always, the station wagon was gone, and I knew he'd left sometime in the night. That morning, Dottie told me about a dream she'd had. She was in a house in the country, and a white horse came up and looked in through the window at her. Then she woke up. I want to do something to express our sorrow, Dottie said. I want to have her over for dinner, maybe. But the days passed, and we didn't do anything, Dottie or I, about having her over. Mary Rice went back to work, only now she worked days in an office, and I saw her leave the house in the morning and return home a little after 5. The lights would go out over there around 10 at night. The shade in the children's room was always pulled, and I imagined, though I didn't know, that the door was closed. Toward the end of March, I went outside one Saturday to take down the storm windows. I heard a noise and looked, and I saw Mary Rice trying to spade some dirt, to turn over some ground behind her house. She was wearing slacks, a sweater, and a summer hat. "Hello there," I said. "Hello," she said. "I guess I'm rushing things, but I have all this time on my hands, you see, and, well, this is the time of year it says on the package." She took a packet of seeds out of her pocket. "My kids went around the neighborhood last year selling seeds. I was cleaning out drawers and found some of these packages." I didn't mention the seed packets I had in my own kitchen drawer. "My wife and I have been wanting to ask you over for dinner for a long time," I said. "Will you come some night? Could you come tonight if you're free?" "I guess I could do that. Yes. But I don't even know your name. Or your wife's." I told her, and then I said, "Is 6 o'clock a good time?"
When?
Oh, yes. 6 o'clock is fine.
She put her hand on the spade and pushed down.
I'll just go ahead and plant these seeds. I'll come over at 6. Thank you.
I went back into the house to tell Dottie about dinner. I took down the plates and got out the silverware. The next time I looked out, Mary Rice had gone in from her garden. Vandals. Carol and Robert Norris were old friends of Nick's wife, Joanne. They'd known her for years, long before Nick met her. They'd known her since back when she'd been married to Bill Daly. In those days, the four of them, Carol and Robert, Joanne and Bill, were newlyweds and graduate students in the university art department. They lived in the same house, a big house on Seattle's Capitol Hill, where they shared the rent and a bathroom. They took many of their meals together and sat up late talking and drinking wine. They handed the work they'd done around to each other for criticism and inspection. They even, in the last year they shared the house together, before Nick appeared on the scene, bought an inexpensive little sailboat together that they used during the summer months on Lake Washington.
Good times and bad, high times and low, Robert said for the second time that morning, laughing and looking around the table at the faces of the others.
It was Sunday morning, and they were sitting around the table in Nick and Joanne's kitchen in Aberdeen, eating smoked salmon, scrambled eggs, and cream cheese on bagels. It was salmon that Nick had caught the summer before and then had arranged to have vacuum-packed. He'd put the salmon in the freezer. He liked it that Joanne told Carol and Robert that he'd caught the fish himself. She even knew, or claimed to know, how much the fish had weighed. This one weighed 16 pounds, she said, and Nick laughed, pleased. Nick had taken the fish out of the freezer the night before, after Carol had called and talked to Joanne and said she and Robert and their daughter Jenny would like to stop on their way through town.